Succession number 4638, reel number 4.
Tape number 4, Mr. Shoya. And I take it that was the beginning of the Arab-Jewish troubles of that time?
Yes, that was the first real action. We were all taken back to camp, warrant officer and his wife and our two selves, by armoured car that had come down to pick us up. Now, the armoured cars were stationed at Ramleh. It was number 2 Armoured Car Company. And their normal duties were out in the desert patrolling pipelines and generally doing the rough police work that the police couldn't get around to. And they had all, I should think, about more than a dozen armoured cars and support vehicles, WT vehicles and that sort of thing.
These were Royal Air Force armoured cars.
Oh, yes, Royal Air Force armoured cars. There were actually, so to my knowledge, there were only two lots. One was one armoured car company, who were based in Iraq, and number 2, which were based at Ramleh. And they did a really good job of work with their radios and the rest of it.
What sort of aeroplanes did you have at Ramleh?
At Ramleh, to start off with, we had Fairey Gordons, and we also had Harts. Now, these were in 6th Squadron, which was a detachment of 6th Squadron, which was based at Ismailia. And they changed every now and again. One or two of the Gordons were over to belonged actually to Ramleh, were for the senior staff officers at Jerusalem to come and use to fly in when any particular flight was necessary, and also to keep their hand in, to keep their badges and all this sort of thing in the pilots.
So it was a sort of communication.
Yes. One of the persons I remember who they flew was Tubby Clayton, Tok H man. And I happened to be Tok H at the time and met him. But I went in the Fairey Gordon as well as escort to him, and they took him to Rutbar as he was en route to Iraq, and that was quite an interesting trip. Again, I got sent out again, although I wasn't an actual air crew member of that squadron. I was the only air gunner in the HQ signals, only what air gunner, and that's why I got selected for this. It was going out to search for lost pilots again, who used to come down in the desert and get mislaid, as it were. And one day I was asked to go out to search for this particular airman that had got lost in the desert from Amman, and we flew over to Jordan and past Amman and along the pipeline, and our job was to find a certain area to land so that I could fix up a ground station. I had a mast strapped alongside the fuselage of the aircraft and act as a link between aircraft searching for him and the bases, because the communications were stretching a bit. Well, we flew around and around, and a bit of a dust storm come up, and our petrol was getting down a bit, and then I had a signal to say the bloke had been found and rescued and returned to base, which we did. But we got over Jerusalem, which, as you know, is on hills. There's all hills all around there. And just as we got over Jerusalem, our engine stopped. The prop just went flip, flip, and stopped. Now, the pilot, who happened to be an airman pilot, stuck the nose down. And we had more faith in airman pilots than the commission type. But he stuck the nose down, and she started up again. But it was only using up the dregs of petrol as it drained forward, you see. But this time, he'd got clear of the hills more and was coming down onto the rough landing ground. Well, it wasn't a landing ground, it was all rockish and sand and stuff, and he put the nose down, And I thought, well, this is going to be nasty, you know, we're going to get knocked up out of it. And as he got near to the land, he was slowing it up beautifully, just gliding, and we could see we were drifting, so he was side on to the wind, and he turned it into the wind, ready for a touchdown. And as he touched down, it happened to be on the edge of a ditch, a wide ditch, and he hit the first part of the ditch and bounced across and stopped almost dead on the other side. And because the wheels were what we call donut wheels. They were big, fluffy things, and you could just imagine those in a fairly soft sand stuff. Stopped dead, and that was beautiful. All I got was a bruise and ears my shot for. So again, he got out, and we all got out. He said, "We're out of petrol. I'll go out to this village," which was Latroon, "and see if I can find a phone and ring up, see if we see what about it." So as he went, I thought, "Well, that's a bit silly. I've got a wireless mast here." And by this time, Arabs had come streaming down the hillsides, and I said, I had a fitter with me, and I said, "Here, get this aerial mast up, and get those blokes hold the guy ropes," you see, which they were only too willing to do to get mixed up in this affair. And my aerial, which was a bead type aerial, I stuck in the top of this mast, which was hollow, and they held the mast up with guy ropes, and I called up Ramley, didn't get any reply. Now, I think that was because we was in the skip distance. I was so close to it, my signals were shooting over the top, but I called up Jerusalem, and Jerusalem being up there was alright. Jerusalem got my message. So I said, "Well, will you pass to Ramley, and for your information, that our aircraft has force landed, we're out of petrol." And I said, "That's it, closing down," wrapped it all up. The time the pilot got back, they got the message twice. They got it from him, they got it from me. So I'd fulfilled my duty, that was the main thing. And I got my aerial strapped back on again. And well, within 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, along come the armoured cars and a support vehicle with them, loaded with petrol, cans of petrol, which they put in the aircraft, and the CO was with them, and the flight CO for the squadron. And he said, I'll take it back. So he and the sergeant pilot got in, we came back in the armoured cars, and they took off. After getting the wogs to clear the stones away, and they took off and flew back, because when they got back, there was all my wireless friends. Where are
any other unusual duties, particularly interesting duties, whilst you were at Ramley?
I can't think of anything otherwise interesting, because we were confined to camp. You see, 1936, when that trouble started, just before then, we were confined to camp, and that was it. We only went out under armed escort. But nevertheless, what we did have, there were convoys going. You see, the government there, people had to travel from village to village, town to town, do their business and work and shopping, all the trimmings. But of course, they've been ambushed and killed. So they did a convoy system, the same as our Navy did in the 1418 war, and this one. And there would be so many lorries with troops, and then buses with the passengers and more troops, so you've got quite a long line up and to go into different places, and the travellers would know where they were going to be picked up, and that was it. Now, they still got stopped. They'd be going along the road, and the road would be blocked with old tins and rocks, which had to be cleared to get by. And of course, as soon as they stopped, the Arabs in the orange coats would open fire on them, and the troops would hop out. I could picture something there. The troops would hop out and return the fire. Well, whilst also they'd want air support, because sometimes they got a bit hot there, you see, and they'd want to get them cleared out while they cleared the thing that was blocking their way and get on again. And they had a system of sending XXX, which was an urgency signal. Now, that was received immediately by us at Ramley, and we had our telephone board just near the radios, and as soon as the man said XXX, this chap on the telephone board would call the duty pilot in the hangar, XXX. An engine would be started up, and by the time it got in, the pilot got in there, and an air gunner, it'd have got the position from this XXX call, and that was passed. And they used to reckon within 3 to 4 minutes that aircraft would be airborne and over there in practically no time at all. And of course, he would start taking action, dropping a few small bombs and shooting them up with Lewis guns to clear them all back.
And that used to keep them quiet, did it?
That would clear the way, yes. Mm. And this was going on most of the time.
I should have asked you earlier, but how did you get from Singapore to Palestine?
By troop ship, the same way that we came out. And they were doing the same thing, dropping off servicemen at each port of call, as it were. And as it happened, I'd done about between 2.5 to 3 years at Singapore. And I had at least another two to do, because the overseas tour was 5 years plus, depending on the times and dates of the troop ships. And that's how we did. They dropped us off at port side, and then we came by train from there to Jerusalem and started off from there.
And then you, shortly after this, caught another troop ship back to England.
Yes, I had the same business again, going back by train. A little bit hairy, because the trains were all being blown up by that time. And we'd had been confined to Canada, of course, for 2 years with this trouble going on. And we caught another troop ship at Portside and came back to England, where I was posted to back to Felixstowe again.
Did you get a great welcome when you got back to England? There was a great
hilarity. Only by my parents and family, nobody else. Yes, that was quite good. But I was time expired by this time, you see. I'd signed on originally for 8 years with the Carlison IV Reserve, and my 8 years were just about up. I hadn't long to go then. And I got back to Felixstowe, and at the same time I had my tapes come through. I was made corporal, and I hadn't been there very long at Felixstowe before they stuck me on a job, a very important job. An aircraft was coming around the coast, and it was most important. I can't think what it was now, but we had to keep watch. And I was brand new to this place, so I said, all right, I'll go in and watch the operators. I went into the office, and the operators were on watch, and I said, well, I'll go and get some secret books from next door. And I went in and unlocked the safe. This was early on a Sunday morning. Unlocked the safe to get the book out, and went in and prompted the operators. Unfortunately, I didn't lock that safe right away. And an officer who was apparently on the lookout for he was a troublemaker, came in the office and took one of those books. Well, this was a terrible thing, a secret book. And I caught him at it as he was coming out. He wouldn't give it back to me.
That was a code book, I suppose.
Oh, yes.
Code book.
Yes.
Mm.
And I thought, well, this is it. I'm going to do something about this, because I was brand new corporal on the place, and I wasn't going to be there long anyway, because I was going out of the service, and I couldn't have something like this happen. So I rang up the signals officer and told him, and he apparently had trouble before with this same person. And he went along and saw the group captain, and this chap got a raspberry and got our book back. But it just showed me how clever and crafty you've got to be, especially being new to the place. Had I been an old sweat there, I would have been well prepared for it, you see. It wouldn't have happened. Well, from then onwards I went to where did I go to? To Witten. To Witten from there. And I joined the squadron there, which were Blenheim, short-nosed Blenheims, and I only had about a month to go before I was discharged. There was one incident there. I was still an air gunner, although I was a corporal. We used to get paid extra money for being an air gunner, and they'd been putting me down for air gunner pay, and I hadn't been getting any flying in, you see, and the chiefie was dead keen on me getting airborne, so it would cover him for putting me in for this air crew money. He got me one day. There was a Blenheim going to Brooklands, and at this time they were doing direct entry pilots and all this sort of thing, and he was taking somebody with him. So they got me, he got me all kitted up, this chief, by the duty pilots up with parachute and the rest of my gear and getting ready to go on the plane. And as I waited, the pilot came up and the chief, he'd gone, he was sitting rubbing his hands, you see. And the pilot said, "What do you want, Corporal?" I said, "Well, I'm coming with you to Brooklands." "Oh, no, you're not," he said. "I'm taking these other two pilots over there for you." "Oh," I said, "oh, that's all right then, sir." Stood back behind the duty pilot out of sight, you see. And he revved up his engine and blended him, and away he went. And I come out behind the duty pilot, and there's the chief waiting to see me, and he wasn't at all pleased. Well, from there, it was only a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, and I was out as a civilian. And I'd been recommended by the signals officer at Witten to Air Ministry, and Air Ministry had re-employed me as a civilian wireless operator. And they transferred me to Hornchurch once more as a civilian wireless operator. Whilst there, one of the DF operators, also a civilian, had left to join a post office, and I took over his job in the DF side. Now, it was a very elementary DF to start with. It was called a Chandler's Adcock system, and it consisted of swinging around a wheel with two great plate aerials on it. Most cumbersome, and would take about a good 5 minutes to get a bearing and a homing course and so on. And then there was it was getting on, it was what, 1938 into now, and they started bringing in experimental stuff, and who should come onto the station and into a new DF Hutton site at a place called Sutton's Farm, which was Hornchurch really, but Dr. Robert Watson Watt, the radar, and he had this new DF, a cathode ray DF, and we were all agog to see this. And it was a wonderful piece of equipment after what we'd been using. A cathode tube with the face of the compass and its reciprocal bearings on the inside, and it was two sets, and a telephone dial to ring for altering frequencies. Now, we had an oscillator set at 45 degrees, which was necessary for the working of this, and we had two squadrons at that time in Hornchurch, both on different frequencies. And whichever operator called me up from the station and said he'd got an aircraft in trouble on a certain frequency, I could dial that, and I could switch the sets over to that frequency right away and line them up. And it meant that when an aircraft called, he only had to identify himself, and I'd got him right away. I'd got his bearing and a quick flick of the switch, and I'd got his sense, I'd got his homing course, so I could tell him his bearing or his homing course to get to Hornchurch. And this was done in seconds, whereas the other was done in minutes. And the pilots were amazed, because they didn't understand it, they didn't believe it, until one day, I think again, I'm not sure, well, I think it was a flight, it might even been a squadron of 54 squadron, it was 54 and 74, 74 were the old times.
Both fighter squadrons, weren't they? Both fighter squadrons.
Oh, both fighter squadrons, and they were flying gauntlets and gladiators. And this flight was up one day, and they were going across country somewhere. They got a new CO. And he got lost. A mister come up, and he didn't have a clue. And he called and said so on the air. He said that he was lost, he didn't know exactly where he was, and would I give him a homing course. And his speech, the volume, I should say, was about what we call strength twos, taking fives as the maximum. And I could just hear him. But I got his trace. I got a small trace, a very small trace. It was there on my tube. So immediately I could answer him and say, "Yes, your homing rate, whatever his call sign was, from my call sign, your homing course is so and so and so and so and so." So he said, "Understand, so and so," repeated it, you see. And I said, "That's correct." And he hung up. He switched off, and within seconds he was on again. He was really worried. He said, "I understand. Will you give me a further homing?" So I gave him another one. This time it was altered by a degree or so. And this went on for, I should imagine 6 calls at least. And each time, the final time, he said, "That's fine." He said, "I know." He said, "Your signals are getting louder and it's lovely." He said, "I'm glad to see you. I'll be seeing you, you see." And I was being a bit cocky. I looked outside and I could hear him coming. And they went straight over the top. And as he went over the top, his transmitter was on. And the loop, his line of from a transmitter, opened up, because it struck all four aerials at once and gave me a loop around my tube, you see. So if I hadn't seen, I knew that he'd gone on the other side. So I called him up again and I said, "Your homing course now is so-and-so. You're now on your reciprocal." He said, "Fine." He said, "I know where I am." I said, "Well, if you turn around and reduce height, you should come below the cloud. The cloud base is so-and-so." Well, my job to know that cloud base. But I knew it was about 1,500 feet, you see. And I'm stepping out of line. My mate was an ex-naval man. He would never have told him that. So he descended through this cloud base, fairly craftily, and he came right over the middle of the area. He was delighted. And he was so delighted that when he got down, he sent all his pilots up to come and see me and see what I was doing.
Then I think it wasn't very long before the Royal Air Force invited you to come back again in uniform, was it?
Yes, they called me back, and I was made a flight sergeant, and I was training RAF volunteer reservists and people of that nature in different towns. And then I was posted for operational work to Mountbatten on Coastal Command again, much to my pleasure. And there I could put a lot of my experience into good use. And one of the most interesting and thrilling parts about that trip into Mountbatten was the fact when the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, and all his staff officers were going out to the Middle East to sort the things out there, trouble out there. And I was passed a message from the my signals officer, which had to be sent to Air Ministry for onward transmission to Gibraltar. So when I got this message, I gave it to my teleprinter operators, who passed the message, and I was told, and I told them in turn, that we must have an acknowledgement of this message, that it had been transmitted and received by Gibraltar, and it had to come from Air Ministry. Well, we got it through to Air Ministry, but we couldn't get the acknowledgement from Air Ministry that they'd done this. And this was going on for minutes, and it was hopeless. You just couldn't get any sense out of them at all. So, meanwhile, and knowing what the Prime Minister is, there was smoke and fire coming from out of the operations briefing room, and the
Winston Churchill was actually at Mountbatten waiting to fly out.
Yes, what it was. And the group captain of the station, because he was taking the can back, he came along to the signals office and he said, "Well, can't you do something about this?" So he said, "Well, can you do anything, Chief?" So I said, "Yes, sir. You give me permission to break wireless silence," which was an unheard of thing. You couldn't break wireless silence at any time. I said, "You give me permission to break wireless silence, I'll get rid of it." So away the group captain went, and I presume he either got it from a staff officer or the Prime Minister himself, I don't know, for me to break the silence. And meanwhile, while he'd gone, I took a chance and thought that I'd probably get it, and rang up my pal, who was a chiefie at the transmitting station at Staten Heights. And I said to him, Ginger Mant is his name, he was an old timer. I said, "Can you get me the SWB8B, which was a special transmitter, beamed onto Gibraltar on such and such a frequency?" So he said, "Yes, it's all set up," he said, "and it's just a matter of switching on," he said, "and I'll dab the key when it's ready." So with that, I went back, got this message again, told them to cancel it to Air Ministry. I got on the set and moved my junior operator to one side, and I said, "You keep the log and listen." And I called up Gibraltar using their civilian call signs. Gibraltar answered immediately, and I made the priority no break queue, which was one of the highest priorities you can get, and sent a message. And within 3 to 4 minutes the message had gone, I'd closed down with Jib and finished. Now the funny thing is that that could have led to all sorts of serious repercussions if that message had been decoded by an enemy. It may have been, but we never heard anything about it. You see, it went through. And what the message I was given to understand, and it's pretty obvious, that this message was for an order to Gibraltar to send out fighter aircraft to escort the Prime Minister and his staff across the other half of the Bay of Biscay, because we would escort him out to halfway, and then our aircraft had to come back because they hadn't got the fuel for any further, you see. And this all went off perfectly, and I never heard a thing about this. But one of the most interesting parts about it is that as soon as that operator at Gibraltar, I've never contacted him, but I thought about it. Well, I thought about it, but never got around to it. I recognised, and he probably did with me, the Morse, the signals. I knew as soon as he touched the key that he was an RAF operator. I mean, it could have been the German. Same as me, I could have been. He must have recognised the style, the manner in which it was sent. I recognised, I thought, now that's an airman. And I bet he was an NCO. Because I often wondered afterwards, I really would have liked to have met that chap and see what his reaction was. Yes. And that was about it from there. From there onwards.
Well, unfortunately, it's not part of this session to go into the war, so we'll have to leave it at that. And thank you very much indeed, Mr. Scheuer, for a fascinating story.
Operators.